This morning we'd like to read and comment on some conversations with Nirsagadatta. And he says, as long as you take yourself to be a person, a body, and a mind, you are living merely on the surface. We said yesterday that if one wants to go north, then one doesn't turn the cart pointing south. In other words, it is the way that you begin, the very beginning of practice, which is going to determine the outcome. And it's the direction in which you're looking, moreover, that is important. We have to remember that the practice of Zen is not a technique or a series of or collection of techniques. They're not methods or techniques by which we can come to awakening, or we can fix something that's wrong, or we can improve things or change things. It is precisely this illusion of control, the ability to add, subtract, alter what is happening, that is this great illusion that we have. This is not to say, of course, that we do not make any kind of contribution. And of course we do. But the major contribution that we make is the contribution of interference. When this person talks to you about practice, we're not suggesting that there is something that you can do which you apply, and in applying that, you will get beneficial results. But it's more pointing in a direction in which to look. And by looking, of course, we don't mean looking with your eyes or even with your inner eye, but turning your whole orientation towards. And as we say, if we have got our orientation, if we are turned towards fixing things that are wrong, then this is looking south. And it is here that practice merges very closely with technique. Nirsagadatta is challenging the view that we have, the orientation that we have, the way that we look at things at the moment. This orientation, which includes being a body or a person or a mind or even a soul or a spirit. It is this notion of a separate, distinct entity which is at issue here. And with that view of a distinct entity comes the notion of that distinct entity being in the world. And most people feel that they are in the world. They feel they are part of the world. The world is like a big box, and in that box are houses and cars and trees and roads and people and things. And they themselves are in that box. And then when we say that the trees, the fields, the mountains, these are my face, people think, well, there is this entity that has a face. How can those fields, those mountains, those trees be that face? And then they struggle to come to terms with that, clinging all the time to the separate entity attitude. And exactly the same when one starts practice. There is this entity, and somehow I have to find out what exactly this entity is that is called me or I. What does it consist of? What is its form? What is its shape and colour? And when we ask somebody, well, what is your colour? And they point to themselves, and we reject it. They're nonplussed. Or when we say, how big are you? And they sit up straight. And this also is rejected. They don't know what to do, because after all, I'm talking, ask about you. And this person interprets that as, I'm talking about this separate entity, this person that is sitting on this tongue in this room, always placed in or on or around or whatever. And then we ask, where are you when a bird sings? The whole thing is just stunned silence. There are some people that feel this is a silly joke. This is a very silly to ask this question. Actually, I came across a couple of members a long time ago now who were giggling over the fact that he had been asked in Doksan, where am I when a bird sings? And they were giggling. They thought this was very funny. I don't realise that in that question is the fundamental mystery. That question itself points to something which is far beyond entities in the world. And this, when we're asking, who am I? We have to recognize that there is an issue here. We cannot start off taking it for granted that we know what the question means. Because if we think the question means, what are you, that person, or that entity, that separate, distinct individual, and if they're then struggling to make sense of this question within that context, then of course they're bound to be frustrated. It's useful to look upon myself as a man. This is useful because if I don't, I might run myself into difficulties in society. I might go into a woman's toilet, for example, and that wouldn't be exactly the thing to do. And it's useful to look at myself as a human being. Otherwise, I might land up in the zoo. And so, therefore, it is useful to see oneself in certain ways. Also, there's a certain use in considering the mind as something separate, as an entity, as something that can be investigated by itself. Unfortunately, this has seemed to have gone out of style these days. When this person was young, when we were taking our degrees and so on, psychology, the study of the mind, flourished. There were all sorts of very interesting, very worthwhile texts, books, but written by people like Eric Fromm and Karen Horney and Carl Jung and Freud and all kinds of very fascinating insights into the human condition by seeing the mind as something worthy of investigation. And so therefore, we're not saying that the words, the language, the categories, the identities and so on that we set up for the time being are not useful. But we must also always see this as if there is a mind, as if there is a separate individual, as if I am a man, and so on. When we see it in a provisional way, then, of course, as we say, there is no problem. But we don't do that. And this is the power of words, as we have seen, that words have that capacity to fix things as absolutes. Words have that capacity to freeze the water of life into the blocks of knowledge. And so, therefore, the first challenge with this question, who am I, is to see that one is going in a very definite, but as far as one is concerned, unknown direction. This means that we must challenge everything, even that which seems so obvious. It seems so obvious, I am here and you are there. This seems to be absolutely indubitable. And yet, this is provisional. It's as if you were there and I am here. He says, as long as you consider yourself to be a person, a body and a mind, separate from the stream of life. And here we have to be very careful. We must not see the stream of life as apart from us, separate from us. We sometimes use the metaphor of a whirlpool, these little whirlpools that you see in a river or in a stream. If you stand by the bridge just a little way down the road and see the river as it comes under the bridge, you'll see that it's made into little whirlpools, little individual separate entities that float along in the river. But of course they're not separate at all. They are the river. They are the water. But momentarily they can be seen as something identifiable apart from the river. And this is a useful way sometimes of seeing our situation. But then we mustn't then start looking round outside ourselves for this stream or this oceanic awareness or this cosmic consciousness or this over-self or whatever it might be. There is this that is beyond the conscious mind. The conscious mind is, if you like, the little whirlpool. But then there is the stream, and the stream, you could say, is I am. Some of you who have been working with me with the forum will recognize it as what I call dynamic unity. But that's not very important. The whole point is there is a dynamism, there is an ongoingness, there is a vitality, and this vitality is what we could call, for the moment, ourselves. And we sometimes say that So, for example, following the breath is a practical demonstration of the line in the Lord's Prayer, "Thy will be done." And you could say that this is saying that the will of the stream of life be done. The stream of that out of which this sense of self, this conscious sense of consciousness, the sense of being something separate and individual arises. And when we see it like this, when we see that there is the sense of self-will, and then we get the feel for that which is beyond that self-will, we can then begin to loosen the hold that this concept, this idea of a separate, unique, individual self, that we can release the grip that that has on us. When one's following the breath, for example, one is releasing the grip of that sense of self. This is why when people are following the breath, we always insist that they follow the breath and not control it. Because this is the very problem that exists, that the sense of control, the sense I am the controller, reinforces the sense I am a separate individual. And the sense of I am a separate individual reinforces the sense of being in control. They mutually support and sustain each other. And this goes for when one's working on who am I. You are. This is, we've said this time and time again. We spent a whole day yesterday, a whole hour yesterday talking about this. I am, from the beginning, all beings are Buddha. And this, if you like, is what we mean by the stream, the dynamic unity, the wholeness, whatever you like to say. Actually, it's a pity to say anything, because once we've said it, we have already begun to freeze it. Already that identification process is underway. And it is that sense that there has to be something, there has to be some entity, some form, something that has some kind of existence that is the controller, that is the motivator, which makes things happen, which is the thinker, and so on. It is quite beyond, utterly beyond the conscious mind to conceive of the truth. It can only conceive of shadows, a light it cannot conceive of. And so when you're asking this question, who am I, you're not, although you're working with the unknown, and indeed the unknowable, you are not working with the non-existent. You're not working with that which is simply a good idea. It is so important that you see this. This is faith. Faith is being open to a truth without the support of consciousness. It's being open to the truth without the support of consciousness. And the truth is beyond consciousness, it's beyond concept, it's beyond idea. But nevertheless, this is the only reality there is. This is why it is something of a mystery to this person, why it is that people have such difficulty working with I am. It is itself. It has its own evidence of being. And that own evidence of being is what we mean by reality. Nothing else has its own evidence of being. It is self-affirming. It is self-realizing, if you like. And he goes on to say, if you think you're a person apart, separate from the stream of life, having a will of its own. And this is where we come to the question, who is it that walks? When people sort of meet this question superficially, they say, I walk. And really what walking is will in action. It is, there is a sort of a dynamism, a will, a dynamism, an intentionality, a going towards, which is basic. We do not have a static condition out of which movement arises. The basic condition is dynamism. And the best example of what I mean by dynamism is music. Music is always going somewhere. When you listen to music, there is always that ongoingness of music. If you listen to, say, one of Balestrina's masses, there is wave upon wave upon wave of motion. And yet nothing is moving. There is a dynamic, there is movement, but nothing moves. And this is what this person means by dynamism. In fact, parts of music are called movements. And it is this, out of this, that walking, talking, eating, and all of the other activities of life emerge. It's an interesting thing that animals, birds, fish, insects are always on the move. There is that famous question, why did the chicken cross the road? Because it is dynamic, because it is movement. One often wonders, why is it the squirrels rush across the road? Why don't they stay on the other side of the road? Because they're alive. And to be alive means to be in action. And there is a kind of ongoing will, if you like. Even to sleep requires this ongoing will. Sleep is an activity. One goes to sleep. We've got that expression deeply into the English language, going to sleep. And this is the will, but we claim it up for ourselves, seeing ourselves as a separate entity. We then claim this will for ourselves, and we say that it is I do it. And yet, when you look, just if you really are attentive and sensitive, there is no I that walks, there is walking. Because that is life. It's like sitting still, sitting upright as you are at the moment, is intense action. There's intense activity going on. Right now, there's a dynamic quality to sitting up. And one sees it, the different degrees of this, when a person is really present, really with it, really there, in other words, really alive, the back automatically straightens. And when a person isn't, then their back automatically sags, and there's the difference. So he says, as long as you take yourself to be an entity, and ignore this ongoingness, this vital, intelligent ongoingness. And you believe that you have your own aims, your own goals. What we have are dreams, our wishes. It sometimes happens that our dreams, our wishes, coincide with the stream of life, in which case our dreams or wishes are fulfilled. And one of the secrets of making a good decision is to be sensitive to what the stream of life is telling you. This is why it's a very good idea, if you've got a big decision to make, to sleep on it. How often do you hear that? I'm going to sleep on it before I decide. Why? Because when you go to sleep, you go beyond, temporarily, this conscious sense of being a separate individual, and the individual that one claims is making all the decisions. And very often, the decision comes in that way. We always remember this when this person and Jean were trying to decide what we would do because we was not able to live any longer in South Africa under the regime that existed there. And we just didn't know what to do. And then one day, it was quite a moment, when I said to Jean, I know, we'll go to Canada. It was just like that. I didn't make the decision, but we lent ourselves to that. And it was like being on a toboggan after that. One just went downhill, and it was unobstructed. It was amazing, totally unobstructed. It's like when we bought this place here. This person didn't make any decisions. It was all, it was inevitable in a way. It just happened in a way. But at the same time, it happened in a very wonderful and specific direction because the stream of life was carrying it. And this is really where this comes again into our practice. Because most often what happens in us is that it is thwarted by our interference. I say the contribution that we often make is a contribution of interference because we're afraid or because we're hesitant. And this is why when one looks inside oneself, there is this profound dissatisfaction, this profound restlessness. And this is why we ask you to have faith in that profound restlessness, that profound suffering or anguish that there is, because that is that dynamic stream that will beyond your will, that is thwarted by the contradictions and attitudes and so on that exist in you. All of your habits are directed towards comfort, towards security, towards certainty, towards peace. This, you might say, is what the personality wants. And it's interesting, we've already created an entity called the personality. But there is this set of forces, these sets of attitudes or inclinations. And they all are directed in that direction to comfort, security, peace and certainty. But there is another, there is this will, there is this stream of life, there's this dynamism, this that you essentially are, that is going in an entirely different direction. And this is why it's a struggle, so to say, upstream. This is why we have the carp downstairs. Because it's the one stream, the real stream of life, struggling against the inertia of habit that is going in the other direction. He says, as long as you take yourself to be a person, a body and a mind, separate from the stream of life, having a will of its own, pursuing its own aims, you're living merely on the surface. and whatever you do will be short-lived and of little value. And this is why it is that your practice goes in spurts. You do a little bit of practice and it's going well, and then it fades out, because you move from the real dynamism that is driving you in this practice, which is extremely uncomfortable, which is, there is a great deal of tension involved in it. There is a great deal of pain, actually, real pain, that is involved in this as it's trying to push its way through the knots and crannies of existence. You leave that, and then you sink into again the drifting into the comfort zone. He says, it's mere straw to feed the flames of vanity. You must put in true worth before you can expect something real. What is your worth? You must put in true worth before you can expect something real. What is your worth? What does that mean? And this is what the questioner asks. By what measure shall I measure it? And then he says, look at the content of your mind. You are what you think about. And this is the interesting thing. What is it you think about primarily during the day? Are you thinking about your concerns, your worries, your frustrations, the problems that you have, the failures that you are, and all the rest of it? Or are you just simply totally bottled up in performing the actions of your profession or whatever it might be? He says, are you most of the time busy with your own little person and its daily needs? This is again why you're exhorted to come back periodically during the day to open up, to cut through, to allow. In other words, one's breaking up this massive habit structure and allowing in some light to appear. If one just is involved 100% from the time you get up to the time you go to bed in your problems and concerns and troubles of life, then, of course, when you come to sit, this stream of life, this dynamism, will have to push its way through so much concrete, so much obstructions, so much confusion. But if periodically you make that effort to just break up, just open up, just be aware, just allow for a, it doesn't have to be on a permanent basis. You're not trying to be permanently present throughout the day. This would bring about a totally artificial and almost robotic kind of behavior, which would be undesirable. You do see it among some Far Eastern monks, that kind of almost robotic attitude. But it does mean that you do break it up periodically. This person used to have fasts. Sometimes we would have up to a 3-day fast, because there's nothing like being hungry to bring you back to what is real. Or we used to have reading fasts in which we wouldn't read for a week. Or there was those little silly little things like wearing the elastic band on the finger or the watch on the wrong hand, or all of these ways by which one would break out something different, something you had to contend with, which was not in the ordinary run of affairs, which would be like an alarm clock, which would wake you up. And it's in this way that one breaks up this, as we call it, the massive concrete of habit. He says the value of regular meditation is it takes you away from the humdrum of daily routine, and it reminds you that you are not what you believe yourself to be. And again, this is why when we give workshops, we insist that one undertakes a regular, consistent practice. And really, if one hasn't got a regular, consistent practice, if it's on again and off again, then really it's a waste of time to come to Sesshin. Without that, at least that commitment to a steady, consistent routine, then the concrete is too thick. It means that there isn't, one would have to wait for another while until life gives you enough anguish and disappointment and frustration that by itself life breaks up the concrete of its own. But with that, by constantly coming back to the question, who am I, in a serious way, in a way, in a devoted way, by giving oneself devotedly to this question, then we're able to tune in to this current of life. And of course, there's nothing as valuable as a sesshin in order to enable us to do that. And during a sesshin, one must be fully committed right from the beginning, no matter what it's going to take, no matter how much pain you're going to have to suffer in the process, that you're going to be fully committed to whatever practice it is that you have undertaken. And give yourself constantly, moment by moment, instant by instant, to whatever the practice is. And this doesn't mean gritting teeth and forcing yourself, but it does mean that one is open to the pain. Because if one is going to do this, if one has this consistent, merciless attitude towards practice, then it will be painful. There's no question about it. If you're working, for example, on I am, then if you're aware, you'll notice there's almost like waves of tension constantly pass through the mind. And when this tension reaches a certain peak, it is almost unbearable once one is really with it. And one has to really sort of be there. Be there in the full vigilance of the moment in order to be able to allow that peak of that tension to pass through. And if one does that, one notices then the practice becomes easy for a while. But not very often, not for very long, at least not in the earlier part of the sesshin. Almost as soon as that wave has passed through, another wave of tension is going to come. And it is these waves of tension that sweep us away. The thoughts and dreams and so on that come in all because the pain of the tension is too great. We've developed this sort of safety valve, you might say, in our lives. Some people actually have whole scenarios that they dream through in order to escape the tensions of existence. It comes out of the contradiction of existence. But nevertheless, if one is open to it and gives oneself in this way, then this inner dynamism that we've spoken about acquires more and more power. But with the power comes an increase in power, intention, and pain. And this is why we sometimes say to people that this is truly the hardest work, if you're going to do it, is the hardest work you'll ever do. We say that there are these mountain monks that go, they run 40 kilometres a day, and they sometimes don't sleep for a week and all the rest of it. This is just feeding on self-will, that's all. It's just a kind of stubbornness. It comes out of the need to be unique. That kind of effort is sustainable because of the need to be unique. It's like these Olympic runners. You get people in Olympic training, for example, and they put themselves through all kinds of hell because they have this vision of themselves winning the Olympics. And so therefore, this kind of thing, there's nothing in there. But this one where you have to let go of all hold, you've no longer got any ground to stand on even, other than the ground of pain. You've got no idea why you're doing this. You cannot have an idea of why you're doing this. You've got no direction, real direction to go, because, as we say, I am has got no characteristic whatsoever. There's no hook. There's nothing that you can... It's not got a feeling. It's not even got a taste. The taste of me or the ego, has got very definite taste. But I am has no taste. It is ordinary, but even that is too much of a description. And yet it is the only reality. And so necessarily it's going to take a great deal of courage to do this work. Or if you're going to ask, who am I? It's the same kind of thing. It's going to take courage. It's going to take that determination in the face of this kind of obscurity and darkness. But you see, the faith comes out of the dynamism, because the dynamism, as we've said, is real. There is reality at work when you're opening yourself to I am, or to a genuine question, who or what am I. You're now working with life. Life is on your side now. It's funny, it's the wrong way to put it, really. There is no you for the life to be on the side of, but it'll do for the time being. You must take it for what it's worth. He says, the value of regular meditation is it takes you away from the humdrum of daily routine and reminds you that you're not what you believe yourself to be. And this is it. As you enter into this question, who am I? Or as you enter into I am, or as you work with Mu, or whatever your koan might be, you're breaking down this shell of distinctness, of ego, of the sense of being apart from. I remember reading a book, this was a long time ago, in which the author, he was some kind of psychologist, who was really totally affronted by the fact that in Zen, the true self is no self. He didn't use those words, I forget exactly. But what he was ranting on about was exactly what I'm saying at the moment. He said it has taken us thousands of years to develop this personality, and now the Zen Buddhists are telling us that we just have to casually put it aside. And that this sense that this personality is something so valuable, something that we must really cling to, that it is our the crown of existence, the human personality. But this is, the personality is so much froth on the stream, so many bubbles, that's all. The reality is beyond that. When you see a cat jump or run or stalk a bird, or when you see the way that it moves, one must have a great deal of humility. One must really have a great deal of shame that there is that magnificence there that one cannot emulate in any possible way. But he says, but even remembering is not enough. Action must follow conviction. Don't be like the rich person who has made a detailed will but refuses to die. Yeah, they do exist. And then the questioner says, is not gradualness the law of life? And the Nirthagadatta says, oh no, the preparation alone is gradual. The change is sudden and complete. Indeed, it is the suddenness and completeness of it which is the hallmark of a true awakening. It's like a bombshell. And the reason for that is that it is the final burst through of this totality that you really are. There's that very famous saying that they said of Buddha, and Joshu picked it up. There's a couple of koans, if I remember, about this in the Hekigan Rokun. Throughout heaven and earth, I alone am the Honoured One. The Honoured One. And this is so much like the statement of a very arrogant, very conceited person. In fact, if a person said that, one would know that they were arrogant and conceited. And it is interesting that the truth and its mirror exist in all of us. That it is the sense of self mirrors the truth. And it is the emergence of the truth which is so sudden. It cannot come piecemeal. You cannot have bits of one. This is, again, something that one really has to enter into and see, that oneness is oneness. Oneness is complete. That there's a categorical quality about this oneness that I'm talking about. And so therefore it presents itself whole and complete in a moment, in an instant, or beyond even an instant. He says, gradual change does not take you to a new level of conscious being. You need courage to let go. And this is what we were saying about when you're working, for example, on I am. You're working with nothing. It's so diaphanous. It's so, one can't describe it. It's like space. One's working, trying to grasp space. And it takes courage to do that. It takes a certain kind of almost foolishness to do this. It's almost like this person used to feel that we were committing a kind of spiritual suicide by doing this, because everything else kept offering itself. What about this? What about that? And there would be all these voices, no, don't be silly, what are you doing this for? Why don't you try something else for a change? And it is that courage, that resoluteness, that somehow has to be summoned up if one is going to really, truly give oneself to this kind of work. And the person says, I admit it is courage that I lack. And Nirsargadatta says, it is because you're not fully convinced. Complete conviction generates both desire and courage. And you're not completely convinced because you don't really hurt enough. It's only when one hurts so much that one realizes I can't go back. There's no way that I can go back and try to live the life that I've been living, because I see it isn't a real life. It is one pretense after another. And the pain is there, the shame of it, the sense of worthlessness of it, the uselessness of it, is so acute that one has to go forward. And this is why, again, we say, have faith in your pain, in your suffering. It will take you home. You will not be taken home by wishes and dreams. You cannot. They're insubstantial and they have no value whatsoever in this kind of work. You cannot seduce your way through. You cannot pretend. You cannot go along as if you were working. It is that just giving yourself without reservation, it is a kind of merciless practice, we sometimes say. But at the same time, it is a practice that is fully within the stream of reality. This is real that we're talking about. The practice that we are suggesting is something which is real. The only reality that this person has come across in 80 years of life is the kind of reality that one can encounter in times of deep meditation.
Les quatre vœux.
Tous les êtres innombrables, je
vais de libérer les patients aveuglés sans fin. Je vais de vaincre les barrières infinies de moi. Je vais de franchir la grande voie du Bouddha. Je vais de l'atteindre. Tous les êtres innombrables, je fais vœu de libérer les passions aveuglées sans fin. Je fais vœu de vaincre les barrières infinies du Dharma. Je fais vœu de franchir la grande voie du Bouddha. Je fais vœu de l'atteindre. Tous les êtres innombrables, je fais vœu de libérer les passions aveuglées sans fin. Je fais vœu de vaincre les barrières infinies du Dharma. Je fais vœu de franchir la grande voie du Bouddha. Je fais vœu de l'atteindre.